certainly want to echo Alan's welcome to everyone today, especially those that are visiting with us. Hope that you will find our worship together to be that of giving praise to the God of heaven, our Creator, and to His Son, our Lord Jesus Christ. Recently, in my own personal morning Bible readings, I was again looking at the Gospel of Mark. And I've read through the Gospel of Mark a number of times since I started this Bible reading exercise when I retired from my job a number of years ago. This time when I read through it, my attention was drawn really to the second half of Mark's Gospel. And I saw what has been there all along. I'm absolutely certain about that. But at least I saw in that second half of his Gospel the fact that it was devoted to Jesus preparing his apostles for the ultimate climax of the gospel story, his death upon the cross and his subsequent resurrection from the dead. And it's there in such a prominent way that I basically said to myself, how have you missed this all over the years, all of the ways and times in which you have read the Gospel of Mark? And so what I want to do this morning is simply kind of share this thought with you, and basically looking at the second half of Mark's Gospel from three basic things: how he spent time creating an anticipation in his disciples for what was about to occur, and then what he did, which was the immediate preparation for those events, and then finally for their realization. And that really encompasses the entire second half of the book of Mark, from the 8th chapter all the way through the conclusion of the book. Before we actually get into those points, I want to preface it with a couple of things. As Mark's narrative about this unfolds, it becomes obvious to us that Jesus had to patiently inform his disciples as to what actually was transpiring in his ministry. I think in our Bible class Wednesday night, Brother Chris mentioned that the apostles must not have had a very good memory, because Jesus could feed 5,000 and the next time something come up, they wondered where the food was going to come from. And I think you really see that as we progress through this lesson this morning, that as human beings, their ability to recognize and relate and apply the things that Jesus said is astounding about how difficult it was for them. However, the second observation that I would make, and this is for you to make use of this thought as we present the materials this morning, is as Jesus had to do these things over and over and over with them, and their experience and their comprehension and understanding and ultimate realization of the meaning of the things that Jesus said were often hindered by their humanness, by the limitations that they had, and by how they responded to what Jesus said, that we need to challenge ourselves if those aren't some of the same ways that we react when Jesus is revealed to us in his word today. So let's look at that. And so the first set of things we want to talk about are the things that Jesus said to them in anticipation of what was about to occur. And these are three statements that are essentially identical, that occur three times in relatively close proximity of time in terms of what it is that he is telling his disciples. And the first of these occurs in Mark chapter 8 and verse 31. And it says, "And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again." Now this statement just didn't kind of pop into existence in the midst of a bunch of unrelated other things. For it to get to this point in the book of Mark, there were other things that had occurred that brought about this discussion. Jesus had fed the 4,000, and in Mark 8 and verse 15, we find him warning his apostles to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. And he had to get them to see that what he was talking about was that their focus shouldn't have just always been on physical bread, but that leaven in bread is an influencer that makes the bread rise and makes it what it is, but that he was concerned about what influenced them as his disciples, and particularly as Jews, what influence the Pharisees and their approach to the Old Testament scriptures could be. And so he had to tell them, you need to be aware of what's going on around you and what other people might be teaching and giving examples to you of what your life should be. Then he took the disciples off by themselves and he asked that famous question, and there's no doubt we're more familiar, I think most of us, with the parallel passage in Matthew 16, but in Mark 8, Mark records that time when he asked those disciples, "Well, who do men say that I am? And who do you say that I am?" And Peter responded first and gave that famous affirmation that's recorded in Mark 8 and verse 30, "You are the Christ. You're the Messiah. You're the promised one. You're the one the prophets spoke about coming." And it's in response to this confession of Peter that Jesus began this process of saying, "All right, you believe that I am the Christ. Do you understand what that means? Do you understand what that means to me and to you because of your relationship with me?" And so he uttered this phrase, this passage that we're very familiar with. He began to tell them what was really going to happen to him because he was the Christ. And the response to that, the reaction to that, on the part of his disciples was a rejection of that statement. And Peter voiced the objection for them in Mark 8 and verse 32, where he said, "We're not going to let that happen. We're your followers, and we're not going to let this happen to you." And so that led basically to the rejection. We're not going to let it happen. And that led to Jesus rebuking the disciples. And this is where Jesus says to Peter, "You get behind me, Satan." And Jesus rebukes Peter in Mark 8 and verse 32. He says to him, "You are not setting your mind on God's interest, but upon man's. You're looking at what I have told you from the totally wrong perspective." And that resulted in Jesus making a public declaration. He says in Mark 8 and verse 34, "If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." You have to follow me where I am going. His message to Peter is, don't stop me from doing what I'm going to do. You follow me. Well, in just basically a few more days, in the next chapter, as we have it recorded in the Gospel of Mark, in Mark chapter 9 and verse 31, we find Jesus saying these words to this very same group of people. He was teaching the disciples and telling them, the Son of Man is to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he has been killed, he will rise 3 days later. Now, between the rebuke and what Jesus said to them in Mark 8, and Jesus saying this to them in Mark 9, some pretty significant things have happened. In the first part of Mark chapter 9, Jesus takes Peter, James, and John with him up onto a mountain, and there the transfiguration occurs, and Moses and Elijah appear. And that has an impact upon Peter, James, and John. You remember the story that's actually in Matthew 17. Peter says, we need to build 3 tabernacles. We need to keep Moses and Elijah here with us. And you too, Lord. And that voice comes from heaven that says, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. You hear him. And so, the select group of the apostles gets to witness this amazing event. And on the way back down the mountain, back to join the other apostles and the disciples, Jesus tells them in Mark 9 and verse 9, don't you tell anybody about what you've just seen until after I'm raised from the dead. But verse 10 tells us there's a problem with that. It says they did not comprehend what he meant by rising from the dead. They had just seen Elijah and Moses brought before them on the mountain. Men that were dead. And yet when Jesus told them, you keep this to yourself until I have risen from the dead, they still didn't have any idea what he was talking about. So they come down from the mountain, they find the other disciples, and they have been frustrated while Peter, James, and John are on the mountain with Jesus. They've been trying to cast a demon out of a young man and have not been able to do it. And Jesus has to intervene and ultimately cast this demon out. And here he makes this declaration as he is doing this. That he says, all things are possible to him who believes. He says this, remember the man, Jesus asked him, do you believe I can do this? And he said, oh, I believe, help my unbelief. But I don't believe Jesus was just saying this for that man. He was telling his apostles, you're struggling with such things, and in order for you to get to where you need to get, you need to understand that the power of God is such that if you believe him and you will follow him and you'll put your faith in him, you will be able to do things you don't even believe or comprehend that you're able to do. And he continued to affirm by bringing up the statement, which we've already read once. Now this is the second time. Saying, I'm going to go to Jerusalem, and there the leaders of the Jewish religion are going to put me to death. And I'm going to be raised again. And the disciples reacted 2 ways to this. As we're told in Mark 9 and verse 32. They didn't understand what he was talking about. Peter, James, and John didn't understand it as they were coming down from the Mount of Transfiguration. But now you have the whole 12. And this is the second time Jesus has said this to them as a group, and they don't understand. And the second thing is, not being understanding it, they were afraid to ask him anything about it. They didn't want to show their ignorance. So they just kept quiet. So that brings us to the third occasion, which is in Mark chapter 10 and verse 33, where Jesus says to them, "Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles. And they will mock him and spit on him and scourge him and kill him. And 3 days later, he will rise again." Notice that Jesus here gives them even more detail than he has given them in the past two statements. He gives them details as to how he will be treated. And then he puts a time frame on it. They will kill the Son of Man, but he will be raised in 3 days. Now the background of this is, again, between the statement in Mark 9 and this one, a number of things happened. First, after the occasion there in Mark 9, after the transfiguration, he takes his disciples back to Capernaum for some R&R, to rest, and to give him the opportunity to teach them. And he teaches them several lessons there. He also engages publicly with some of the Pharisees in Capernaum. And then he starts his journey to Jerusalem. And this is his last journey to Jerusalem. He's now approaching the final week of his life. He had the famous exchange with the rich young ruler in Mark 10, verses 17 through 27. And after that exchange, when the young ruler went away sorrowful, Jesus again emphasizes the importance of faith, saying that with people it's impossible, but not with God. For all things are possible with God, Mark 10 and verse 27. And so he affirmed to his disciples that the rewards of discipleship would far outweigh the suffering that it might require. And he takes them aside, just the 12, and utters these words to them as he begins their journey to Jerusalem. And so we might, in our own thinking, posit, well, they're going to get it this time, the third time. They're going to get it. And they get a little bit more of it. But when you look at their reaction, their response to him, it is not untypical for human beings to respond this way. That is, they missed his point. And instead of becoming focused on what they should be focused on, they became distracted. Because evidently they understood that this was him talking about the kingdom promises, and the Messiah was going to suffer, and they are starting to get that. But they start arguing amongst themselves, that Mark 10 verses 35 through 40, as when that happens, which ones of them are going to be most important in the kingdom. It starts with James and John. But the other disciples got angry with them, and Jesus finds them arguing with themselves about, okay, when these things happen, who's going to be the next in charge? So, Jesus had to teach his disciples to overcome the conflict they were having with each other by learning about what real service is and what it means to be a servant of Jesus Christ. And so in Mark chapter 10, verses 43 and 44, he has to say, you're missing the entire point. That whoever wishes to become great among you shall be the slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. This death I've been talking about is for others. And you need to learn to give yourself for others the way I'm going to give myself for you. Before we go on to the rest of the lesson, I just want to stop there and think about, and we notice how difficult it is for even these 12 men who have spent almost 3 years by this time in the presence of Jesus, seeing what he could do as his powers were displayed, hearing him teach, all the experiences that they've had, and yet they have trouble with their humanity. They can't put their human concerns aside. They have trouble focusing on the message that Jesus was giving them. And so one point at this point of the lesson is to challenge each and every one of us. That we ask ourselves the question, how often is our commitment to discipleship hindered by those same problems? Because we're not looking in the right place and we're not seeing the right things and we're not being servants. Each of us can be challenged by that. But there's two quick points to the finishing of the lesson. Jesus did all these things in anticipation of what was going to happen at Jerusalem. And now he is on his way to Jerusalem with these disciples. And in Jerusalem, there are two or three things, and it would depend upon how you count them. There are going to be two on this chart. That he does to specifically prepare the disciples for these events that are about to take place. And the first that's recorded in Mark 14, verses 3 through 9, is the anointing of Jesus with oil. He's at the house of Simon the leper. This is a very famous gospel story. And the woman comes in and breaks the box, or breaks open the vial, and pours it upon Jesus' head and anoints him. Now, there's a lot of peripheral things in that chapter. The disciples argue about what could have been done with the money and all those kind of things. That's not where we're at this morning. What we're at this morning is the fact is that what this did in terms of the message that Jesus had three times already given them. That we're going to Jerusalem and there the chief priests and the Pharisees are going to oppose me and they're going to end up putting me to death and I will rise again. So the first thing he does is prepare them for the fact that his burial is imminent. And this woman, by the providence of God, the direction of God, does what she does. And Jesus says in chapter 14 and verse 8 of Mark, she has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for the burial. I told you I was coming here. And that is the result. I was going to be killed and I was going to be buried. And she has gotten my body ready for that burial. And then the last one, and you can make it two things or you can make it one thing. I have grouped them together. Is the last Passover and the Last Supper. Mark chapter 14 verses 12 through 26. Passover, the high of one of the two highest events under the Jewish law. But very significant as it is to Jesus' death and burial and resurrection. because the Passover symbolized God's redemption of his people from slavery. And they observe that every year. And Jesus is about to make the Passover sacrifice that will redeem his people from the slavery of sin. And so he meets with them to observe that Passover. But he changes it. After they have finished the Jewish observance of Passover, Jesus basically institutes the Lord's Supper. Now, I don't know why it's this way, but we're going to have the Lord's Supper in just a minute, and we all take turns making comments around the supper. And my observation is we use Isaiah 53 a lot, we use 1 Corinthians 11 a lot, we use Matthew a lot, we use Luke a lot, and it's very rare that anybody gets up to do the Lord's Supper and uses the Mark passage. But that's what happens in Mark 14. And he takes the bread and says, "This is my body." And he takes the cup and he says, "Drink from you all of it, for this is the blood of my covenant." And then Jesus predicts the apostles' failure. He basically tells them, "You're all going to desert me. Peter, you're going to deny me." The disciples are still unaware that what they are facing, even though he's told them that three times on their way prior to them coming to Jerusalem. And it's the night before all this is going to happen, and they still have no clue. But he tells them, "You're not going to do too well in the next 24 hours, in the next 12 hours." But the most important thing about this is it doesn't end with a rebuke from him because of their impending failure of faith. But rather, how it ends is he says, "After I have been raised, I will go ahead of you to Galilee." To me, that's the most significant verse in this story. You're going to fail. Peter, you're going to deny me three times before the rooster crows tomorrow morning. I am going to die on the cross and be buried. But after that's all accomplished, you come and meet me in Galilee. What a promise of hope. I don't know about you, but I have failed miserably so many times in my life being what I ought to be. And I generally don't need the rebukes. I'm probably one of the most self-rebuking people in the whole world. Occasionally I get them and occasionally I need them. But what I need a whole lot more is the hope. The hope that is offered to these disciples on this night. We're going to win this battle, Jesus said. And then the rest of Mark, approximately two chapters, is spent talking about the things that will happen that will bring this all to accomplishment. And these are all things, one, that you already know. You're assembled here this morning. I am convinced that you already know these things. And secondly, I admit to you that we could spend a lot of time talking about them, but because you already know them, I just want to point them out to you so that you see them in connection of this story, that Jesus tried to get them to anticipate what was going to happen. He did things to specifically prepare them for what was to happen. And then they happened. And Mark records that in his gospel. He records the betrayal of Jesus by Judas and his arrest by the mob in Mark 14, 43 through 52. And then he records the trial and the crucifixion of Jesus in Mark 14, 43 through 15, 32. And by the way, Mark's accounts are the briefest of the gospels about this. So we know a whole lot more about this. Mark just synopsizes it for us. But the point of it is he's basically telling us everything that Jesus told them three times was going to happen. Happened just as Jesus said. And Jesus died upon the cross, Mark 15, verses 33 through 38. He was buried, Mark 15, verses 42 through 46. And he was raised from the dead, Mark 16, verses 1 through 8. But I want us to understand that Mark did not stop there. Because Mark says, there was this glorious reunion of the victorious Jesus with his disciples. That's recorded in Mark 16, verse 7, all the way through the end of the chapter. In which Jesus eventually says to them, I am now the king. You are now my servants. Go out and serve. Now, I realize this morning that there's probably not a person of age in this audience this morning who is not familiar with everything we've talked about. But hopefully, we have been strengthened and encouraged by our observations of the patience of Jesus. He is the Savior of ordinary human beings who struggle with the problems of ordinary human beings. And even the apostles, as much as we look to them as heroes of the faith, were ordinary human beings. And they showed it. Mark shows it to us in this passage. But they can go from failure to victory because Jesus was raised from the dead. And you and I can go from failure to victory. Because Jesus was raised from the dead. And as Christians, we're going to observe the Lord's Supper in a few moments, and it's very important that we do that every Lord's Day and celebrate His victory. But it's also very important that day by day as we live, we recognize that victory can be ours because victory was His. And as was announced in our announcements this morning, Lindsay obeyed that gospel last week. We'll be taking the Lord's Supper for the first time as a Christian. And there are those in the audience that have never accepted Jesus Christ, never confessed His faith, never been baptized. And won't you see that the only source of victory for you in this life, it's Him. You have the opportunity to obey Him. We hope that you will. We invite you to come while we stand and while we sing.